Thank you. May it please the court.
Sure.
Unfortunately, divorce litigation can bring out the worst in clients. With everything at stake and emotions running high, it's not unheard of for clients to do ill-advised or illegal things to gain an advantage, such as improperly accessing their spouse's private email account. But under no circumstances should the client's lawyer ever use improperly obtained evidence or allow his client to infect the legal proceedings with improperly obtained evidence. Now, I use the word infect for a reason. Consider what happened in this case with opposing counsel's direct examination questions. Mr. Eisenstein's client downloaded and read opposing counsel's direct examination questions, 7 pages. By reading these questions, the client knew how opposing counsel intended to proceed. He knew her strategy. He knew what she thought were her strengths. He knew what he thought were her opportunities. And he even made notes on several of the direct examination questions. He then gave the list to his attorney, Mr. Eisenstein. The moment Mr. Eisenstein and his paralegal realized that they had possession and knowledge of opposing counsel's direct examination questions, Mr. Eisenstein had a duty to disclose the matter to opposing counsel.
Doesn't he say that he didn't really know till that morning when he handed over the documents to
That was his testimony at the disciplinary hearing.
Is that a credibility issue? And what's the evidence either way on that?
There are four pieces of evidence that occurred prior to the hearing that demonstrate he knew exactly what he had in his possession. First, according to opposing counsel's testimony, when she confronted Mr. Eisenstein on the second day of trial, which was 4 months after the first day, she said, "Why do you have my direct examination questions?" His response, "They contain a lot of leading questions, and I was planning to object to all of them." And then he walked away. Number two, in chambers, during a heated discussion, Mr. Eisenstein, according to Stephanie Jones, the opposing counsel, admitted, "I did look at it, and once I realized what it was, I put it down and didn't read it." Third, and most significantly, on the record, in the trial court, under questioning from Stephanie Jones, Mr. Eisenstein admitted that at some point in time, he did read the first portion of it and realized it was verboten, something he should not have. In response to that, Stephanie Jones said, "But you never came to me and said, I have your outline." His response, "No, I didn't, counsel. I handed it to you this morning." She then asked him, "When did you get this? Because this is my outline from November, and now it is February. You've had it for 4 months, and you didn't contact me." His response, "I didn't have to." Fourth, we know that Mr. Eisenstein's paralegal reviewed and handled the list of direct examination questions because she stapled it. It has a 3-hole punch down the side and has an exhibit sticker. It was handed by Mr. Eisenstein to Stephanie Jones on the second day of trial. Here's my exhibits for
Mr.
today.
Mr. Eisenstein says if he had realized he had something he shouldn't have, or if he'd known a long time, he would not have admitted it by handing it to her. And that shows his lack of bad faith.
The hearing panel, with a chair who is quite distinguished in family law, was able to hear that testimony, was able to look him in the eye, was able to hear how he attempted to walk back the earlier admissions that I gave you, and they concluded unanimously that he had a credibility problem. And it says that in the disciplinary hearing panel's recommendations to this court.
As always, Mr. Mandel, you do a superb job at representing your clients, as you always have when you've come before us. And you admit the parts that are difficult and try the best for your client. But the DHP recommended the suspension for 6 months.
The DHP recommended a suspension because this is not the first time when you look at Mr. Eisenstein's disciplinary record that he has had a problem with honesty with respect to proceedings in the court.
My mistake, I can't see very well, so I refer to you as Mr. Mandel, my apologies.
I do appreciate the compliment.
You do a great job, Alan.
No problem, Judge. There were pardon me 1 minute. In March of 1991, Mr. Eisenstein was admonished for communicating ex parte with the judge on two occasions during the pendency of a lawsuit. In June of 1997, this court suspended Mr. Eisenstein for 6 months as a result of a guilty plea in federal court to the misdemeanor of willfully failing to submit to an income tax return. In November 99, he was again admonished for communicating ex parte with the judge during the pendency of a lawsuit. In January 2001, he was admonished for failing to respond to the OCDC on three occasions for requests for information regarding an ethics complaint. And very much significant, on July 6, 2004, he was admonished for failing to inform the judge in an ex parte proceeding of all of the material facts known to the lawyer to enable the tribunal to make an informed decision. Specifically, when asked by Judge Dildine of Lincoln County what the exigent circumstances were that required his signature on a consent order presented by a respondent, he replied that it was necessary to get the minor child at issue on a health insurance policy, when in reality he told the disciplinary hearing committee that obtaining the judge's signature on the order was necessary in order that his client regain custody of the child from the parties whom the clients considered inappropriate. I believe that the disciplinary hearing panel made its recommendation of a 1-year suspension because he's been before this court and disciplined on prior occasions. In my limited time remaining, I want to point out what happened.
That's over, like, Eisenstein's been a lawyer for over 40 years. I mean, that's, in any event, there's a number of disciplinary
absolutely.
Issues.
Absolutely, and
I think
that's an aggravating circumstance, Your Honor. He was certainly in his 50s or 60s in 2004. I don't know his exact age. I would have think that this court might be offended that a man of such experience was before the court on that matter and is now before the court again.
Counsel, what weight or relevance does Judge Essener's findings have?
Judge Essener's findings, that is an interesting question. There's a judgment dated in June of 2014 where Mr. Eisenstein made a motion for the judge to recuse himself, alleging that the judge knew that there was an ethics complaint pending against Mr. Eisenstein. Judge Essener was quite upset with that allegation. He says in his last sentence, "It seems disingenuous for respondent and his counsel to assert that the first and only notice by the court of the disciplinary complaint which was received by the court from respondent and his attorney would give a reasonable person a factual basis to doubt the judge's impartiality." Let's keep in mind that the judgment before the court had to do with that limited purpose. It wasn't to determine whether he was guilty of any ethics violations. Now, it does say, and the judge does state, on the record that the respondent adamantly denied that he reviewed any copies of the emails intercepted by respondent. Petitioner introduced no evidence to counter that assertion. He was talking about in the context of the purposes of the dissolution case, not with respect to whether there was an ethics violation. And the disciplinary hearing panel saw this judgment also and felt that the evidence, those four elements I produced before, with respect to admissions made by the respondent, overcame any sentence or two in an order that had nothing to do with whether there was an ethics violation. It had to do with whether the judge should recuse himself. The final point I want to make is that vile email that Mr. Eisenstein sent opposing counsel.
And the decision by Judge Essener not to recuse himself was never appealed, was it?
That I'm not certain about whether that. I do know that the final ruling was appealed before Mr. Eisenstein's client passed away, I don't know whether that ruling would have, was part of that appeal in the underlying matter. The email. Rumor has it that you are quite the gossip regarding our little spat in court. Be careful what you say. I am not someone you really want to make a lifelong enemy of, even though you are off to a pretty good start. That's pretty tough for a young lawyer.
Stephanie, is that a violation of the, being a bully is not a violation of the rules, is it?
I think saying you want to make a lifelong, you don't want to make a lifelong enemy of me is something that's very disturbing, especially when the case is still live.
But did you read that as referring to trying to discourage her from filing an ethics complaint? Or?
That's interesting. I'm not sure what it was, other than an inappropriate burst of anger and something that quite upset Stephanie Jones, something that goes to the injury in this case, which is...
But is it a violation of the rules?
Yes, I believe it's an 8.4D violation of the rules because, as I said, the case is still live. It still was then going on appeal. And to make a threat like that in the course and scope of litigation is something that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. Thank you for your time. I'll have more to say on my rebuttal.
Judge Russell, may it please the court. I've been puzzled by this case. I've stood up here on many occasions agreeing with the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel on recommended discipline. Just can't do it here. To discipline Mr. Eisenstein in this case would make us as attorneys guarantors of improper conduct by our clients. This court is not required to suspend their common knowledge or the way of the world in making a determination. What happened here is very simple. Mr. Koch, Mr. Eisenstein's client, on November 1st, gave him a stack of documents at the end of a court hearing. This was a complicated case. There were boxes of documents. Mr. Eisenstein put the stack of documents in a box, did not discuss it, according to Mr. Koch's testimony with Mr. Koch at the time, did not ask what it was, according to the testimony of Mr. Koch. Put it away. Sometime later, he said to his paralegal, go through the documents and staple them and put them in binders, which she did. No evidence at all that she read them or told Mr. Eisenstein what was in the stack of documents.
So he did no trial preparation coming in?
He did preparation, Your Honor, but he didn't look at those documents, okay? They were in a mass of documents as in the real world, clients give us lots of stuff that the lawyer determines probably is just not even worth dealing with. And this was a mess of papers, okay? And so the paralegal put stickers on them, she put three hole punches, and she put them in a binder. Interesting enough in this case, Mr. Lapp called me, and he asked me for the number, telephone number of Joel's paralegal, which I promptly furnished to him. He never called her. He never asked her questions about what she knew. He never asked her questions about what she communicated to Mr. Eisenstein. They have the burden of proof.
Did you call her as a witness?
I did not call her as a witness, Your Honor, because she wasn't necessary. They had the burden of proof. We had Joel's testimony, and we had Judge Estner's finding, as Judge Russell pointed out, that the lawyer who filed the complaint in this case presented no evidence to contradict Mr. Eisenstein's testimony that he didn't know.
Your arguments are contrary to what the disciplinary hearing panel found.
And Your Honor, I have tried to understand that finding, and I'm going to explain it this way. Number one, as this court knows, it's only merely advisory on this court.
But they specifically found, relying on his testimony, that he may have looked at the outline when it was given to him, but not since that date. He testified that at some point he read the first portion and knew what it was and knew he shouldn't have it.
I think that's an incorrect finding, Your Honor, because I think he did look at it, and he looked at it on November 11th that morning when Stephanie brought it to him and said, hey, you've got my outline. You know, Mark makes light of the fact that What kind of idiot is going to give opposing counsel something that they're not supposed to have, especially a trial outline? When Stephanie brought it to Joel, he made mistake number one, which I'm really willing to concede. He made a joke. He said, oh, yeah, I'm going to object to all your leading questions, okay? His sense of humor sometimes escapes younger lawyers, sometimes it escapes me, but it was a joke. When he told Judge Essner that when he looked at it, he realized it was verboten, that's accurate. He looked at it on the morning of in February, okay, and he realized it was verboten. There was an immediate hearing in chambers. This was discussed both on and off the record, and on the record, Judge Essner made a finding that there was no evidence to support that Joel knew about it before that morning.
Do you agree that whenever he knew about it, he had a duty to disclose to opposing counsel that he had come into possession of obviously attorney-client confidential communications?
Judge Wilson, that's a really interesting question because I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, as I represented this court before. I think at that point he has a duty to do something vis-a-vis his client, but in terms of disclosing it to the other side, for example, I don't know if the client accessing his wife's or hacking his wife's email is a criminal act.
He has, I don't care where he got it. He has obviously confidential attorney-client privileged document in his hand. At some point, does he at that point have an obligation to go to the client and say, I was given this, I have not read enough other than to identify what it is, and I'm returning?
I think at that point he does. But there are some issues about exposing his client to criminal prosecution that, frankly, I'm not capable of answering. Certainly, you go to the client and you say,
"Did he do it?"
He did that as soon as he realized that he had it. They went immediately into chambers. Stephanie already had it.
No, did he disclose to the opposing counsel that he had come into possession of attorney-client communication?
I think she had it already when he discovered, and that's a crucial question in this case. When he realized he had it, it was when Stephanie Jones pointed out to him, hey, you've got this, not before.
Well, that seems to be one of the questions that the disciplinary...
I want to try to answer that because I made a motion at the beginning of that hearing to bifurcate it because I felt that even though Mr. Eisenstein's prior disciplinary history had been more than a decade ago, that it would poison the disciplinary hearing panel in deciding first and foremost whether a violation had taken place. Okay? That motion was denied. If you read the record of the disciplinary hearing panel, it's about one quarter this conduct, alleged conduct, and three quarters Mr. Eisenstein's alleged past sins. It was impossible, especially for the layperson on the committee and the other folks in the committee, to divorce themselves from that. Okay? This case, Your Honor, is about what Mr. Eisenstein knew and when he knew it. And they've got the burden of proof in showing that he had that outline or knew he had that outline before February, the date of that hearing. Judge Essner found that they had no evidence to support that. Okay.
Well, who didn't have evidence?
Judge Essner had found that Stephanie Jones had presented no evidence.
He didn't find that the OCDC's case was inadequate, which is what we're here to decide.
But I think his finding after listening to the evidence is telling in this particular case. By the way, Stephanie Jones, in her deposition, and she did not appear live at the disciplinary hearing panel. She was having a baby, and maybe I should have postponed the hearing and made her come live. But in her videotaped deposition, she admitted she really didn't have any evidence that Mr. Eisenstein knew about this outline before the February trial date.
Did the judge in chambers make a finding that he didn't know about it until that morning?
The judge made a finding that petitioner introduced no evidence to counter the assertion of Mr. Eisenstein.
Okay.
That's the exact wording.
And the evidence was his own testimony.
And Stephanie Jones. And the testimony, most importantly, Chief Justice Breckinridge, of Mr. Koch, who testified under oath. And Mr. Koch testified under oath that he accessed the emails, that he gave Mr. Eisenstein a stack of documents in November.
Why didn't you? If the paralegal was going to corroborate his testimony, why didn't you call her?
I'll take responsibility for that, Judge Fischer. Okay, I really honestly felt that the testimony and the way the facts had been presented had already taken care of that problem, especially given Judge Esner's findings and the testimony of Stephanie Jones, that she had no evidence that Mr. Eisenstein knew about it before before November. What they they're doing here is they're making a tenuous connection that because the paralegal stapled and marked some and put stickers on some documents that somehow Mr. Eisenstein knew about.
Doesn't that create an inference one way or the other?
Just about that,
how you want to take it.
Well, that he knew about that particular document. My question, Judge Fischer, is that enough to take a man's livelihood away? Is that tenuous connection enough to take a lawyer who has practiced for more than four decades, has had some complaints in the past, but that's given the context of handling 14,000 pending cases. The suspension had nothing to do with his practice of law. It was a personal income tax matter. Do we take that gentleman at his age and basically impose a death penalty based on that tenuous connection that somehow the paralegal who wasn't called, even though I was, we were more than cooperative, Mr. Lapp, in the course of his investigation, and that brings up another problem, but Mr. Lapp, in the course of the investigation, didn't call her. The problem we have, and this court needs to address, is we do have difficulties with email questions, obviously. But what has happened in the disciplinary process is, no offense to gentlemen like Mr. Lapp, they've become prosecutors. That was never the role, okay? The role is to discover the truth.
Well, it's also to protect the public.
And to protect the public. And that's done by a thorough investigation, not by a prosecutorial zeal to take people's licenses away. Okay? Part of the problem we have, and I feel comfortable in saying this, because we have a great chief disciplinary counsel, we have a great disciplinary system, is the people running the system, especially in St. Louis County, have become entrenched in their positions. The special representatives have all been there a long time. And I will tell this court, they act just like federal prosecutors. It's no longer about finding the truth, it's about putting a notch on the belt. The email that was addressed to Stephanie Jones, I would characterize as intemperate. It's the kind of thing that years ago we would write a letter to co-counsel, put it down on the table, and look at it and say, you know what, I'm really not going to send that.
But are a hearing, is it your assertion that the hearing panels are also prejudiced?
I think I think the hearing panel, Judge Tittleman, in spite of their best intentions and their volunteers, we have two lawyers and a layperson, were unduly prejudiced by the overwhelming attention to past sins. The focus was not, well, the focus in the hearing was not on what Mr. Eisenstein did or didn't do.
If we do not find that the record supports your characterization of his conduct, if we find the record supports the finding of the DHP that he got it, that he read it, that he knew what he had, and that he chose not to give it, not to alert counsel, what is your argument as to the appropriate sanction?
Well, I, first of all, Judge Reckners, I would be deeply, deeply hurt that I'm not believed.
No,
and I mean that as a joke.
It's your characterization.
Yeah,
of it.
You know, if you take a look, if you take a look at the ABA standards. I think if you accept that, which I don't accept, but if you do, then his behavior is more negligent than culpable, and a penalty of less than suspension would be justified. I think
he knowingly had attorney-client confidential information and did not disclose it.
I think. Number one, that I would be shocked because there's no evidence to show that he had it.
Well, I'm reading, it says, these are his answers. I told you that I had read thee, that at some point in time I had read the first portion of that and realized that it was verboten. It was something that I should not have. But you never came to me and said, I have your outline, however you came into possession of it, did you? No, I didn't, counsel. I handed it to you this morning.
Exactly. Everything took place that morning. And one of the comments made by one of the people on the hearing panel, which I thought was very incisive, was, are we really talking about what it means by it? When Mr. Eisenstein was referring to it, he was referring to the stack of documents.
And again, if I do not interpret that transcript the same way you interpret it, then what is the appropriate punishment?
I think something less than suspension, which in this case would be a death penalty, for Mr. Eisenstein and the four people that work for him.
What should he, Mr. Mandel, you have an excellent reputation, and you often embrace your clients with that reputation when you take their cases. What should have been done at that point when he discovered that he had the...
Well, at that point, your first question is to your client. Okay, how did you get this? Okay, that's the first question, because the client may say, well, she gave it to me, or was laying on her desk, or whatever. That's the first thing. Then you got to consider whether you should go into the judge and say, I have discovered that my client has improperly obtained evidence that I was not aware of, and I need to withdraw from this case. Okay, which is something that you need, that maybe you need to do. There are things that you need to do. Mr. Eisenstein was not given that opportunity because Ms. Jones immediately went back to Chambers and they had a hearing on the record in Chambers. And I know I keep coming back to this, Judge Breckenridge, but Judge Esner was the man on the ground. He was on the battlefield, and he made the determination that there was no evidence that Mr. Eisenstein knew. I'm going to finish up because my time's up just by saying one thing. The email was intemperate. Mr. Eisenstein is a former Marine captain. He won the Silver Star in Vietnam. He was in combat for over 2 years. Okay. We owe him a little bit more than to take his license away for what we consider to be inattention or an intemperate email to a young lawyer who was gossiping about things in the courthouse. And I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you.
I don't know whether to take the comment about my zeal and my prosecutorial style to be an insult or a compliment. I take my job very seriously to protect the public and the integrity of the profession. I feel I have to take a moment to defend myself. I've been on the job for 10 years. I've been before this court before. I've never been accused of doing anything but my job. I do want to point out that the hearing panel did consider Mr. Eisenstein's great service to our country. His good character is certainly a mitigating factor, but they also considered the aggravating factors in this case, which included the several prior disciplinary offenses, a pattern of misconduct, multiple
but
offenses.
Generally speaking, this 8.4, would that be enough, generally, separate from the other stuff, enough to suspend for a year?
The 8.4D, Your Honor?
Yes.
If all we were talking about was a threatening email, although as disgusting as it was, I agree with you. I don't think we would be talking about a one-year suspension. But consider it a part of the whole process where he gets caught with the goods. They come tumbling out. He never meant for opposing counsel to know what he knew, but they did come out, and he continued to fight. He continued to fight during the proceedings. He continued to fight during the disciplinary proceedings. The one thing he hasn't done is apologized. He hasn't owned up to it.
He has a right to defend himself.
He certainly does. He certainly does. But if he knew he had it, which I think the evidence is clear by a preponderance of the evidence, if he said, you know what, opposing counsel, I know under Rule 3.4A that I cannot conceal a document. Here's a document that is inappropriate for me to have. I apologize, and then go ahead and live with those consequences, we'd be in a different place than we are today. He instead has escalated the matter and insulted and scared and frightened an attorney who was just trying to do her job. And I respectfully request that this court adopt the recommendations of the hearing panel and impose the discipline that the hearing panel has recommended. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted.